We know in some instances what brings contentment, joy, and sometimes happiness. Nourishing and building social relationships, taking care of our minds, taking care of our bodies. But we still find ourselves chasing money, status, power, and myself as well. My question to you is, would you be open to an AI solution that tracks your social activities, your social media, your email, and even controls it, tracks your biometrics, if it will lead to more contentment in your life?
Oh yeah, 100%. Right. So happiness is the spikes that we feel, the endorphins that we feel all the time. And I think if we overwhelm our bodies with constant endorphins, it becomes the new norm, and then we're always seeking for the next pleasure, the next thing. I think that's what we see. We get the money, it goes to our bank accounts. We get that spike of endorphins, or I want more of that. That felt great. How do I do this? Whereas contentment is more so the state of, I'm happy with what I have. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be striving for more. You should always be striving for more. For me, it's education. Knowledge is power. And so that gives me my contentment and gives me this happiness to know that I'm learning something new. And so the two go hand in hand, but they're not the same. And so, absolutely, I'd want an app that does contentment. I don't want it to, I feel like sometimes social media is there to give a rise out of somebody, right? And so they can give you the middle ground, and then occasionally they'll send you something that they don't know whether or not you're gonna suddenly be like, that's my guy, that's my gym bro, that's my passion project, or I don't like this, it's politically decisive, I don't wanna do this anymore. And it's the reactions. And you can go back to Facebook all the way from, back when we were in high school, where you could like something. And then people wanted the ability to go beyond a like. Let's get a heart. Let's get a thumbs down. At one point, I remember there being a thumbs down. I'm not sure if you remember that. Or a dislike. And then at one point, it disappeared again. And I don't know what it is anymore because I don't use Facebook anymore. I use Facebook for Marketplace. I need to sell stuff in my office. But that's the rise we want. And then at one point, we wanted more people to have likes on our posts. So then we'll say more controversial things. And then Facebook will take that and run it through everyone. And so I think that's where we're starting to get into this endorphin rush of, I need to have this. I need to have this dopamine rush. This is the addiction that we're looking for. Contentment is the removal of that addiction. I'm happy with where I'm at. I'm happy with my own thoughts. I think that's the third part about this, of this AI app, is does it make you think, and does it make you think independently? Or are you the type of person, I'm not saying you, Rashad, I'm saying anyone, are you the type of person who listens to somebody else, and if it sounds smart, you'll just say yes to it? Because your own thoughts are a scary place to be in. Yeah.
How did you get interested in archaeology?
Oh, that's from childhood. My mom jokes that it's because I like gold. I like shiny things. And in King Tut's tomb was shiny and gold. My mom used to teach us that the Indian culture is very similar to the African culture and Egyptians and the Kushites and stuff like that. And as a kid, your parents are always right. Now I just watched a National Geographic channel yesterday, a video on the pyramids in Sudan, and that's the ancient Kushite Empire, and reading into that as well. All that stuff actually is starting to line up. And we also have studies that now show that verbal history is sometimes as good as written history in cultures. And so I think from a young age, my mom just kind of imbued that into me, in terms of explore the past, have an open mind. Just because some expert said it doesn't mean that it's factual. It doesn't make them a god. It doesn't mean that they're 100% right. Challenge the status quo. If we don't challenge the status quo, we'd still all be using the yellow pages because that was the absolute best thing in the world back then. So challenge the status quo and always ask good questions. And if you prove it to be incorrect, great. At least you proved it. But to outright say no because it doesn't feel like it, that I can't tolerate. So that's how I got into archaeology, which is challenging the status quo. She's upset now because I decided to take that to a whole different level and started challenging what is Hinduism. And reading Vedism and reading the texts of the Vedic texts. I've read the Bhagavad Gita. I've actually gone off and read the Torah, the Bible, the Quran, any religious text I could, because I think it's a really fascinating way of looking at how cultures change over time and how people perceive and how cultures perceive that change and what is needed for society. And so those books are also, in a way, a historical archaeological text, because it's the interpretation of reality into a book. And then you also want to line that with what the Greeks had with Strabo's books and stuff, and what Alexandria was. And that's kind of how it kind of all got together. That's why I said there's no clear pathway, and I think that's representative of what our history has been as a species. There's no clear pathway. We are a mixed group of really smart animals that figured out how to create a civilization that it is today.
You know, when I did residency, I was out in BC, and it was really my first exposure to indigenous culture, and then they had us go to powwows, and it was very interesting. And one thing that really, you know, stuck with me as almost a fact that we don't respect indigenous culture is that it's an oratory culture. It's a verbal culture. Contracts are verbal. They're not written. And we force their leaders to adopt to our framework with written contracts. You said something very interesting. And I think the world would be a much better place if our verbal word was a contract, if we did not need written contracts. Now, you need proof that someone said something, and I think that that's accurate, but I don't think it needs to be pen and paper or, you know, keyboard and screen. What are your thoughts on verbal versus written contracts, and how did you learn that a verbal history or storytelling and stories are, you know, I'm curious, because I would think they're less accurate than written history, but from what it sounds like, you're saying that they're as accurate.
Yeah, it depends on how much emphasis on accuracy is placed, right? So we all see the studies on court cases and forensic cases where people will change what they remember. And it's not maliciously, it's just the brain confabulates and changes things. And so what they recollect even a day after, a week later, whatever, is different. What I think the difference here, though, is what do I remember unintentionally? You know, I was walking down the street, I saw a car crash. What do I remember? And usually nowadays, you and I, we just write down our statement right away. That reinforces what we remember, so it's less likely to change over time. If you don't have a written language, what is the next best thing you can do to reinforce? You share that knowledge with somebody else. You share it immediately. And you can either be doing it through song. So now you have a rhythmic pattern, right, that reinforces a memory and engram into your brain. That if it doesn't rhyme or change or go with the tone, you know you missed the prop part. So now you're actually creating a checksum into the actual memory itself. Then you can translate that to the next level, so horizontally, so through the generations and vertically through the generations. And that's what allows it to pass down from one generation to the next. And I'd argue that even sometimes a written contract is not as accurate, because it depends on the context of when that document was written in the environment around it. And also written from a physical nature point of view, written contracts actually don't persist. Let's take the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? You need to use X-ray vision now to unroll them. They don't persist. We know they're really old, they're really ancient, but they're not as good. But oral traditions actually have that. So I think they both have their pros and they both have their cons. I think where the oral piece and the written piece differ, and where I do like a written contract, is I don't have time to put my EMR end user license agreement to a song could be thinking for hours upon end about why I can't, how I'm going to get sued and how TELUS is not liable for anything. And so I think there's a value to that. But I think when it comes to things that are supposed to make us feel proud about our culture, to warn us about things that are important, to tell us about important milestones in our species existence, song has a way of hitting different parts of our brain and making us feel differently. It's the reason why we sing the national anthem every single day back in school, because it brought us together and made us feel proud about being Canadian. That I know we're true north, strong and free. And that will always be with me. Right? I don't need to write that down. And I know that everyone else around me is the same. Right? So I think that's the value of the written stories, the written word versus the verbal word. Yeah. And the culture of writing and stuff like that, for the Inuit piece, you're right. We don't value that, unfortunately. We should. And we now know, and we have been saying this for ages, they've been saying it for ages, that their written word has been accurate. We're confirming that with archaeological data. And it's because somebody challenged us as well. We said, 10,000 years ago, they came across the Bering Strait through Beringia, and that's how it happened. There was a study that came out 2 weeks ago that showed, hey, actually, that may have been 20,000 years ago. Hey, by the way, there may have been 3 migration patterns to North America. And so, you know, Vikings at one point is a more modern one, but there's some talks about how, other groups from Polynesia, they migrated over at a different stage. And so we need to stop thinking about things in a two-dimensional state of this happened, therefore this mustn't happen, and start thinking from an open mind of, yeah, we know one of the components, what else? How else? And we suddenly put an attachment to ourselves saying, let's imagine I'm an archaeologist. I'm not saying this is what archaeologists do, but I have heard stories and I have read books and papers and people who defend their theory so fiercely because they're tied to it. They spent 20 years doing this one research project. And for somebody to come along and question it, that's a whole challenge. Let's take Einstein. He does not agree with quantum physics. It goes against a lot of the fundamental values he had, and he actually spent the last little while trying to fight it. We know quantum mechanics works. We can't explain it, and maybe in some future state we will prove again that quantum mechanics doesn't work. But we really need to be able to say, instead of fighting it, let's work with it.
I think when it comes to things like quantum mechanics, you know, we have an inherent desire to focus on causation and the why, but there is this school of thought, and maybe I'm the only person in the school of thought, is all we can know is correlation. I don't think we'll ever figure out causation. And we would advance our technologies and our society much faster if we simply focused on correlation. This need for trying to figure out why, I think, is slowing us down considerably. Do you have any thoughts on that, on my belief there? And this belief kind of was supported by there's this investment firm called Renaissance Technologies, the most successful investment firm ever, 66% annual returns for 30 years, more than 3 times what Warren Buffett returns. Their whole philosophy is we will look at the correlation, and they're mathematicians, they made an algorithm to do this, between public equities. And if, you know, the price of rice in Brazil goes up 10%, that means the price of Alibaba in China will rise 5% tomorrow for 6 hours. And they're this precise. They're on the average hold time for stocks is 2 days. And then they invest, they remove the human element because they say we worry about the why, and the why is not what's important, because the only thing that matters is the what and the correlations. And causations are impossible to know. There's too many infinite confounding variables and factors in our life. But we're still stuck on this, you know, bringing us back to the VC world. And in the venture capital world, the biggest question is, why are the founders doing this? And my thought is maybe that is not the biggest question. You know, the biggest question is, will the founders stick around, or are they capable of doing this? And knowing why may or may not lead to answering those questions which actually matter, which is a what, will this be a unicorn exit? So what are your thoughts on correlation versus causation? Do we over-index for causation, and are we hurting ourselves in doing so?
So interesting. I think you're in your own school of thought. No, I'm
I'm happy being in my own school of thought, so.
it's something amazing. It's a great place to be. I disagree with that. I think the why, in the sense that VC is actually not even, they do have a why. Their why is make money, have shareholders, dividends, and correlation gets them to that end goal, then by all means, yeah, go for it. Right? I'm not saying that's wrong. They obviously have proven it's right. I think the beauty of this is, can we translate that to a different sector afterwards, right? So if that rice price in Brazil goes up and Alibaba's whatever goes up for 5 minutes, then knowing the why underneath allows us to predict more. And I do believe that at some point, there is no such thing as an infinite number of variables. It's a finite number of variables. We just need to achieve that, figure out the digital twin, and then figure out with that digital twin, how does the universe work? And it goes back to another philosophical thing of, if we know all the variables of the universe and we can put it into a digital twin, then we just theoretically just create a copy of our own universe digitally, which then leads to the idea of, are we just all part of one large
Can we know all the
matrix?
variables in the universe? Can we know why? Or is it impossible to know why the price of olive oil goes up because the price of rice goes up? Is that a
I think
futile
we can.
question?
No, I think we can. I
Okay.
think by saying we can't means that we've given up. And that goes back to our question of the status quo and standstills move backwards. Humans as a species moves forward because curiosity drives us that way. And correlation can show us the why. Correlation gives us the patterns, but we need to dive deep.
I have decided in my work and not my personal life to focus on the correlation path. And I think let's have this conversation in 5 years and see how we've uncovered the truth and knowledge in the universe and what let's share notes then. But let's go on these divergent
Absolutely.
paths and then let's come
Sounds
back
good.
in 5 years.
And don't get me wrong, correlation is important. Correlation gives us, of all the things in the universe, of all the variables, what are the things that are related to each other? Causation tells us how that happens.
Yeah, and my thought is that we can't know. We're not smart enough. We don't have
Can't.
enough information. We're limited by five senses. I think, and as we are now in humans in 2025, we can't know. That's where I've kind of landed.
Agreed. In 2025, humans can know. We're not that smart. I think that's a, I do believe in a hybridized world with AI,
But
where
so AI
AI
is all
helps us.
correlation, right? Like AI doesn't understand why there's no meaning or significance. It's essentially, as you said, right? Like it's all probabilities. It's what is the next character? And it doesn't even know what a word is, right? It's just what is the next, half a P or character that comes after this. And the character, the way it defines character is very different. So, if we're going the AI path, then it's in my, defense, I guess. And this is an interesting debate. It would be all correlation and no causation, because AI doesn't care. There's no caring or not caring, right? It's just all probabilities.
Do you think we're anchoring AI then by making it or forcing it to explain things to us? But if we had let AI go, it'll create its own language, which we know it can do, and have a conversation with itself, which we know it can do, or with another AI. It can run experiments to determine whys. So it can do that, right? The cold start AIs, we have our machine learning AIs that do. That can then change its own base model for learning and then reevaluate a situation. It's exactly what we do on a day-to-day basis. And so we're forcing it to adhere to what we want from a language point of view of, yeah, P is the next letter. But to be fair, we did the same thing, right? I before E except after C, and a whole bunch of other weird and wonderful rules that we had to memorize back in school, right? That's literally what we're doing for AI that we had to do, and we just programmed it into our brains because that's what allows us to communicate with each other. So we're teaching AI how to communicate. We're also starting to teach it how to experiment. And the more we get it to experiment, the more extrapolation it's going to be able to do. I can tell you now, when I was a six-year-old kid, yeah, extrapolation was pretty bad. I could hallucinate. I could do make-believe things and imagine that my Power Rangers toys were fighting the Transformers and all that other wonderful stuff. And that's imagination. That's hallucination. That's what Google's had their AI daydream, you know, whenever it turns off, right? And we actually, you heard the paper that came out last year that showed that giving AIs and their models a break in between will actually improve their accuracy, and AIs do fatigue. So if we let it...
Interesting.
Yeah. So AIs fatigue. And so if you ask a complex question, just like you and I, it will get decision fatigue, and the answers get worse and worse. You need to give it a break. And so it is coming closer and closer to that singularity of being smarter than us. That's okay, because I think its smartness and our smartness are two different smartnesses. Sorry. And together that we actually can become this newer species as a whole. I kind of equate it to the old schools. Are you a Star Trek fan?
No.
No, okay. Original series, Spock, Kirk. Kirk is the emotional individual who's the lead. Spock is the logical person who's the science dude. Sorry, Trekkie fans who listen to this, I said science dude. But the two together are better than them individually. Us and AI are better together, and if we don't go along with it, sure, but that just means that you now have a logical being that is going to be pure logic, which is bad, and we've seen that going bad. Or you're going to have an emotional being, us, that's going to go along on their own, and that's bad too. We see that in the world today, that logic and emotions in general lead to war and hate and suffering. The two together lead to something beautiful.
I think there's a full circle moment here where I may be realizing all causation is infinite correlation loops. And if you're trying to figure out the why, you're just trying to break down two things that may not be linked, and you're breaking on the path, and that's just predicting probabilities along the way. I don't know if I explained that well, but I'm kind of realizing causation just might be, or the why might just be you know, the what repeated over and over again until you get to the why. So, you know, why does a car go this speed? Well, you break it down. You know, why do the wheels turn this fast? What's happening in the engine? And it's just all probabilities of what's. So, you know, I think there's different paths to getting to understanding the universe. I'll pick correlation, you'll pick causation, and we'll see who gets closer.
Fascinating. And you know what? You make a good point there. Like, the why is actually just a high probability of a correlation. Your correlation could be 99% or it could be 1%. And so if you have 99%, you got your why, hopefully. So 1%, there's a correlation. Everything has a correlation. Being on this planet is a correlation.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that it has causation. I can see where your logic is coming from. Yeah.
We are both physicians in the innovation space, so you know, maybe let's talk about healthcare a little bit.
Sounds good.
Do you have when do you have to go, by the way?
I gotta go around noon. At noon. I got enough meeting at noon. Sorry about that.
What is the path to the AI clinical physician? Should physicians be scared? And then where does the opportunity lie for physicians here?
Yeah, and you know, that's a great segue there, right? So you're either the clinician who doesn't use AI, and you can definitely do that. But there's a great book, it's called Deep Medicine by Eric Topol. I'm not sure if you've read it, 2019, if I'm not mistaken. In the book, he talks about how, you know, in that particular year, we as a species have identified 10,000 diseases in humans. I have not memorized all 10,000. I'm pretty sure none of the doctors have to memorize all that stuff. And so that's where the value of AI is. It's protecting the patient in the sense of making sure that all the rare and weird conditions are identified and ruled out. It's ensuring that communication happens in a proper way, in a standardized way. There's good enough evidence now that shows that doctors in the beginning of the day spend more time with their patients than doctors at the end of the day. You know, if a patient, one of your appointments goes over time, then you're trying to get home. You need food. You need a meeting to go to. So you're more likely to give the antibiotics at the end of the day than at the beginning of the day. And that harms, right? Antibiotics harm people. Communication improves people's lives, not just from a social perspective, but also from an understanding and compliance perspective as well. And so when we talk about clinicians being afraid of AI, we're essentially saying clinicians are afraid of finding a solution that, one, we may not understand, but two, we're actually afraid that could be our replacement. I'd say it's never going to be our replacement. It could be our replacement, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. It's more likely to complement us. And in fact, most likely it will just make our jobs really easy. So one thing that we do right now in our office is we do our AI scribe. I've been doing it for about a year now. It builds my notes. And I've had three patients say, I like that note I wrote. Can you just email that to me so I can review it at home? Absolutely. Right? Want a patient handout on some hip flexor stretches? Great. Go online, do a deep research on ChatGPT, say I need some hip flexors, double check it, make sure it's correct. And then send it off to the patient, right? And so instead of me having to spend the time with the patient, which I'd love to do, don't get me wrong, but there's only so much of my time that I have for my patients. For my patient who might have an amputation and I need to modify those stretches, they're getting a better quality of care. And overall, patients and community are healthier. So actually, by not using AI, you're doing a disservice to your community. I think we need to start showing that ROI piece back to the patient and to the clinicians. And we're seeing that, right? So AI scribes have gone from last year of 5% market penetration. Last I heard in the Waterloo region, it's at about 20%.
That's
so we've gone
low.
Past the chasm.
I'm surprised. Yeah.
Sorry?
That's still low. I would think it would be more. There's a lot of physicians I know, and maybe I just have a different collection of friends, yeah.
Yeah, we have innovative friends, right? So within our circles, yeah, absolutely. They all use it. But it's the circles that we're not a part of, right? So if you think of our innovation curve, our innovators make up that first 5-ish%. We got the early adopters that push us to about that 9-11%. Then jump that chasm. We've jumped that chasm now. We're at the 20%. We're going to see a rapid uptake right now until we hit about 50%. It'll slow down eventually, and we will never reach the last 5%. That's okay. They're either going to be retiring soon or they're going to miss the boat. And if they miss the boat, it's not.
I think, when do you think the completely autonomous AI physician is happening in primary care?
Interesting. Cool. So I just gave a talk about this in Sarnia. Actually, 2 days ago. We need to stop thinking about this as us as doing one thing. We do, in the sense that we ask questions, we find a pattern, diagnosis, probability, and correlation, like that's what you said. We test that theory with our physical exam, our labs, imaging, things we do. And then we go ahead and treat. And then we do a self-reflection saying, cool, did we do it well? Did we not? What did we miss? All that other stuff. We'll get better and better over years. But we think it's this large quantum. In fact, it's actually, we are a combination of different machine learning algorithms. We have our strep throat algorithm. We have our shortness of breath algorithm. We have our whatever else algorithm. Algorithms feed into other algorithms. And what we're probably going to start seeing is an AI for cough, an AI for heart failure, for shortness of breath, an AI for anemia. And what it's going to start doing is it's going to start branching off and taking off little chunks of our job. And it's a good thing and a bad thing. One, it helps to, it's scalable, which means more people have access to care. It democratizes healthcare. One of my whys, going back to what our, you know, our conversation about an hour and 15 minutes ago, my why in life is universal healthcare for everyone, no matter what. And if that means I lose my job, okay. Because I need to make sure that I do no harm. And if the AI can give you the care you need at home, so you don't have to take time off work as a single parent or a person who has to work multiple jobs, that you have to decide between paying for food or rent and seeing me in my office, by all means, go use it at home. That's the most important thing, not my job. And so it will start taking out chunks off of my job, and we're going to be forced to, as clinicians, to reinvent what our value proposition is. So we're not going to lose our jobs, but our value proposition is going to change. My value is no longer going to be writing that prescription. And that's the debate we're having right now in Ontario, where we're seeing other professionals doing things that we used to do, whether it's going to the pharmacy and getting a prescription for some basic things, whether it's seeing a nurse practitioner, whether it's seeing a midwife, whatever it is. And so we're seeing that as, hey, this is something I used to do, and now somebody else can do it, and they're not in the same profession as me. But we're probably going to start seeing AI jump into that circle as well. And we're probably going to start seeing it actually tackling some of these conditions that were delegated or that other professions have. And I'd argue that the first sign that AI is coming after or is going to change our value prop is when it actually starts sticking on those 17 conditions that pharmacists can give medications for. Patients perceive this and know it's an algorithm that pharmacists have. Patients also are trust computers more than humans. We did a study in my office with the Canadian Mental Health Association on the use of tablets to screen for mental health conditions, depression, anxiety. And in the feedback form, the reason why people were more truthful on their tablet than talking to me was because, and I don't make them feel bad about depression, anxiety. I recognize mental health as a condition. My patients know that. We have a great relationship. Is that the perception that humans judge and perception that computers are unbiased. We know AI is biased based on training data, but we're getting better at recognizing that. And so if our AI is unbiased, repeatable, can go beyond just the sort of conditions, and I can still get the same service, well, I'm going to use the AI over my pharmacist to get my eye drops for my allergies or to get my treatment for my urinary tract infection. And that's probably going to scale up really quickly. So we're going to start seeing the pharmacist losing that volume. Then they're going to start targeting us as well as clinicians, because we're going to start seeing that volume drop as well. And we're going to start seeing just segments of our profession going away. What the AI is probably going to do that's going to be better than us is when they start taking all those different conditions and build an orchestra of it. And that's your agentic AI. Can you correlate that runny nose and the itchy eyes together? You and I do that all the time. Allergies. But can the AI do that? The moment it can start correlating between them, that's when we start seeing our jobs being replaced completely. And we've got to change our value prop again.
If I'm a founder building in this space, and say that I'm building an AI diagnosis and prescription model algorithm for UTIs, for bladder infections, what piece of advice do you have for me, and what data do I need to present to the CPSO for them to say, okay, I feel comfortable giving this AI a license to prescribe Macrobid for UTIs? Because that you know, once, and this is already happening in the States, there's a bill proposed, and there are medical boards and that are open to looking at solutions and giving them a license to prescribe a medication. What are your thoughts here? What piece of advice do you have for founders? And then how should I be positioning myself to the college or the medical boards in the US for them to say, okay, I have to give this person a license because of the amount of lives you'll save or the decreased wait time or the And the physicians will fight this. I think we both know that. But what advice do you have for this founder?
Because we hold technology to a higher standard than we hold humans, right? So, let's take my stethoscope. Me and my stethoscope are about 60% accurate, right? Maybe 50% to me. But we're not 100%. But the perception is that we're 100%. Or it's not even 100%. Patients know that we're not perfect, and so maybe the perceptions are we're 70 or 80% right. Right? I know
This
it's
is,
60%.
I'll just say one thing. This is very interesting because for pneumonia, the best, and I did a presentation on physical exam findings, sensitivity, specificities, and residency. The most accurate physical exam findings in pneumonia is egophony and tactile fremitus. It's not the stethoscope, but we still use the stethoscope. So it's very interesting we use that, even though we know that that is not the most accurate. But sorry, keep
Agreed.
going.
I actually use I use egophony and tactile fremitus on all my patients
Oh my
I
God.
suspect pneumonia
You are the
for. I
only
do, I do.
physician.
It works, man. It works. I volunteer in Tanzania. I don't have X-rays there, right? I'm doing that, right? I'm identifying potential tuberculosis and bacterial pneumonia for an island of this population of Kitchener-Waterloo. It's like 400,000 people on that island, and they have one X-ray machine. Right, and I'm pretty sure the dose of radiation I'm going to get off that thing is higher than a CT scan. So, I'm really reluctant to send my patients off to that because it's not through their fault, right? It's just older technology, and we work in a capitalistic world right now.
And for the non-physicians
And so,
listening, could you explain what egophony and tactile fremitus are? Because I realize they might not know.
absolutely. No, that's a good point. Yeah. So, I love this topic because it has everything to do with physics and nothing to do with medicine. So sound travels further in liquids versus airs, which is why whale sounds can travel kilometers and through the ocean, and hundreds of kilometers. And sound travels through walls and solids better than liquids. So your lungs are filled with liquid, sorry, filled with air, my apologies. And when you get the pneumonia, you get swelling. Just like how if you hit your elbow, you get swelling, you get fluid buildup. So your lungs get hit with the bacterial infection, your body starts to fight it, it swells up, you get liquid in it. That's why it gets harder and harder to breathe because the air and oxygen can't get through. And so the sound of the letter B in air changes to bay. And so when you're putting the stethoscope on, you get the person to whisper B. And it's not a full whisper, it's just a soft tone, there's a sweet spot. You should hear bay, and anyone can do this at home. Roll up a piece of paper, put one side against your ear, put the other side against somebody else's back, and tell them to whisper bay. And if they're not sick, you should hear bay, 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 bay. And it's different from listening on a stethoscope, where you go, we call it the Christmas tree model, where you listen one side to the other, you compare and contrast, compare and contrast. With agaphony, you go down, and so you do two long sweeping lines like a dress. And so you go bay, 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 bay. But if you hear B, then usually that means sound got transmitted way better, which means there's a consolidation. Now that consolidation just tells us it's a consolidation. Liquid is in there. That could be heart failure. That could be pneumonia. That could be cancer. But the accuracy on cancer is really poor, so I wouldn't be
Just
worried.
stick
But
with
I
pneumonia,
mainly
yeah,
just
for the people listening, yeah.
it's liquid. Yeah. The second one is vibrations, right? So sounds of vibrations. So tactile fremitus is exactly what it sounds like. Tactile, you put your hands on the chest, and it can be through clothing. It has to be on the chest. And fremitus, I don't know what the Latin etymology of that one is. You put your hands on it, and you can actually feel the vibrations on the sides of your hands. You gotta make sure you put it between the ribs because the bones get in the way of the conduction. But you can actually feel the vibrations through your hands. So two really cool and very accurate ways of diagnosing pneumonia. And the old school way, back before we even had X-rays, that's how the house call or how the doctor used to diagnose people. Yeah, that's what agaphony and tactile fremitus is. What was the question that we were trying to answer before? I'm trying to
The
remember that.
question, yeah, it was no, I apologize because I asked you a few other
All
questions.
good, all good.
It was what advice do you have for founders who are trying to get a medical license for a solution to focus on. The example I use was cystitis, but any one of these conditions.
So imagine if I fell asleep in a lecture at med school, and I'm really, really bad at the subject. The most damage I could ever do to a society is just the, 1,500 patients that are in my practice. I don't have that high of a reach. Therefore, the damage to a society is a lot less. You give that to an AI, and it's scalable. Even if it makes a 1% mistake, the impact and damage it can do will be far more than what I could do. And so the need to fix hallucinations is incredibly important. And I know there was a debate at one point saying, no, it's better than humans. We just need to prove it. No. When it comes to human health, and we do see ourselves as the dominant species on this planet, losing a person's life is important, is bad, and we need to make sure we don't do that. And there's levels, right? Like, is this as bad as, hey, you bruised a finger, but what if that bruise isn't a bruise and it's actually a lymphoma? I just went to a dermatology conference, B-cell lymphoma shows up as cutaneous, a cutaneous manifestation of that, right? That is something that we get wrong all the time as clinicians. And I hope AI can do it better than us. But what if that gets it wrong? What if the training data is off and all that other stuff? So number one thing, you will never get a clinician who wants an autonomous on its own AI. So number two is, how do you bring the human into a loop? Because we need to make sure that that helps. And number three is, how do you make sure that human doesn't become complacent and just says, cool, the AI is right all the time. I'm going to just start saying yes, 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 yes. What we actually need to do is get it to start throwing mistakes at us that the AI know is a mistake, but keeps us on edge. So those are your big three. And knowing that when you submit for that application to Health Canada, that you say that. It's a novel idea, it's a new way of doing it, but actually helps to build complacency or prevent complacency. So number two then is, how do you, even a human in the loop, will ensure that humans don't feel like they're being replaced and getting that, and then that step actually leads to a medical directive. And so I don't actually look at this in terms of medical directives. The probability of a bill being passed, while it's being placed forward in the Congress in the United States, I don't think it's passed there yet. And in Canada, it hasn't been placed forward. Like, we're still fighting interoperability. We don't have the equivalent of the Cures Act up here in Canada, unfortunately. We should, and it's kind of sad that we don't at this stage. But we need that. And so we got to start with medical directives, and that's something I'm already looking into, and we're looking into doing medical directives for just plain old algorithms in my clinic at this stage. And so by doing so, that's the first step, and if we show the value of that and the scalability of that and the life saved with that, just like what you said there, Rashad, then we can start saying, hey, what's the next step? How do we make this autonomous? How do we help with the unattached patients? How do we ensure that we don't burn out our clinicians who are taking on more unattached patients?
If you have clinicians in the loop, you have to pay them. And I think most clinicians are something that is completely automated. You know, they would do it for $25, dollars a pop if it takes a couple of minutes. But then you're increasing the cost of this solution, although still better than in person, because that's $37. Yeah, so I can see. I think that's a model that can scale.
The other way of looking at this is, if you're in a capitation model, is the more patients you roster, well, the more money you can make as well. And so if you do a blood and capitation model, the more availability you have, the more likely you are, the more ability you have to actually attach more patients to you.
What tech are you currently using in clinical practice?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. It's funny, it's the simple things, right? Like, it's the stuff that has existed in every other industry except medicine for the longest time. We truly are one of the slowest industries to take on new tech. Voice over IP, right? Having a tree chain in our voice system allows us to actually help to navigate and coordinate patients. We use it's not technology. We actually use a call center for our phone calls for our patients. Makes it super easy in terms of making sure that we have constant accessibility to our schedule for that patient and for them to feel like they're getting care for. Now, as anything, and I make this joke in regards to our emergency room wait times. If you make it more available, and if you drop that call the wait time on your call system, the volume will increase naturally. Because if you know it's easy to get a phone call in, you'll naturally just get more phone calls. It's an Ouroboros, the snake that eats itself. And so we're now looking at, okay, can we introduce like almost like a Google Duo before it even hits our call center that then actually can answer basic questions? And we're trying to figure out how to solve this hallucination problem as well. Where does AI fit into this? Is it an entire tree algorithm and we just make it that easy and then, you know, hit zero, you'll get a human, but you could have got your answer through another way, or is there a different way? So we're experimenting with different AI algorithms on creating a phone tree that's adaptable. We're looking at, so that's option number one, and that's super cool. That one actually exists. There's a company called, this company I just spoke with, they're called Strello AI. They're out of Hamilton. And they actually have an AI secretary for your phone systems. And a couple of claims actually already use them. Highly recommend trying it out. We're still doing our impact on that and trying to figure that out. The next one that we're using here is online appointment booking. So in order to reduce the volume of appointments online, and for folks like you and I, where we're just busy, and I'm not going to stand on the phone saying, well, what about May 6th? What about May 7th? What about May 8th? No, I just want to look at your calendar and book it. And so that one was interesting because when we launched that in Kitchener-Waterloo area, there were different clinicians and different hesitancies with using online appointment booking. You know, I'm not a massage therapist. I'm not a manicurist. You need to be triaged and figured out. I'm like, actually, to be fair, I don't need to triage my diabetic visits. I don't need to triage my hypertension visits. What I need to triage is if it's urgent. And right now, those urgent patients can't get through my phone lines. So I need to get all my non-urgent off of the phone line so that my urgent patients can get onto the phones. And in order to do that, there's a concept of, where can you find the easiest solution as quickly as possible? It's not a concept, it's just common sense. If you log on to your doctor's portal and the next available appointment is a month out, and you get angry, you're like, how could this doctor do this to me? Blah, blah, blah. And you call, and the secretary says, yeah, I can book you in 3 days. Why would that patient ever go back to your online appointment booking platform if they knew they had an option for a non-urgent appointment to get it done in 3 days? Versus if I threw 90% of my appointments online and you go online and, you know, you're offered an appointment in 2 weeks and you call into my office and you're offered 2 weeks, nothing changes.
Yeah.
Then one, that patient's gonna be angry because it's 2 weeks, because expectations are expectations will always be a challenge. But two, next time they need another appointment, they know that what they're gonna get online is gonna be exactly what they get on the phone. The only exception there is that we throw this on our online appointment booking, that acute issues, not emergency, just acute issues, call. We have same-day appointments. But if you call expecting that same-day appointment for a non-urgent thing, we're just going to give you the two-week appointment, not the same-day one. Yeah. So that's the second piece of technology we use. Third piece of technology we use is Prescribe It. It's a product that comes out of Canada Health InfoWave. It allows for two-way communication between pharmacists and primary care providers, or clinicians in general, because there's sometimes questions. Sometimes patients ask questions. Sometimes my prescriptions don't make sense, or we need to make sure that, you know, the insurance companies will pay for it. And instead of doing the faxes back and forth, which requires a fax to come in, my friends have to read it, identify the patient, put it into the right file for me to read it afterwards, this just goes directly to that patient's chart and messages the most responsible clinician. And so Prescribe It has reduced the turnaround time for my patients getting their medications, which increases their compliance. It reduces my front staff time and improves, it decreases fax failures. Faxes fail all the time. It's a pain. Third technology we use, AI Scribe. I've been doing that for about a year. I actually used AI Scribe as part of my capstone project for my one of my courses in my MBA, my executive MBA program. Back then, about a year ago, I only used it on my mental health visits. And I did that primarily because I wanted to make sure I had eye-to-eye contact with my patients. I didn't want to have half my mind typing in jot notes into a computer system. I am fortunate I can type and look at you at the same time, but it's still a divided attention. And so by just having that two-way, or that, you know, the one-on-one session, talking to the patient, one, the visits are actually shorter now because I'm actually getting deeper and better quality visits. But number two, my notes are better. So when I need to advocate for that patient to get time off, I can go back to my notes and articulate exactly why. I can provide the notes as per the to the insurance company to tell them, yeah, this is pretty bad. This person's suffering. We need to support this individual. And so AI Scribe has changed that whole game. So insurance notes now, instead of historically taking, so when I first started 8 years ago, insurance papers used to take me 30 minutes to complete. They reduced down to about 15, 20 minutes with another technology I'll talk about. And now with the AI Scribes, we're looking at like 5 to 10 minutes. And that actually translates directly then to, these are all uninsured services, to my patients then actually not having to pay for my time. It's basically, OMA says it's the physician's hourly rates that we charge for these insurance forms. So my hourly rate, then theoretically, the amount of time I spend on that form drops, and therefore my patients aren't paying as much. And I don't feel as stressed. I hate doing forms. I don't feel as stressed anymore. The next technology we use is e-forms. So e-forms get sent out to the patient pre-visit. In that, they get their the consent form for using an AI scribe. So they're made aware the entire time of what's happening. If they book a particular type of visit, hypertension, diabetes, IUD, weight management, things like that, they get a questionnaire that's specifically tailored to that condition. And so then it asks them a whole bunch of questions, which then facilitates that conversation. Going back to mental health, they will do something called a PHQ-9 or a GAD-7. Those are two questionnaires that help with monitoring a person. You know this, Rashad, but like for all the listeners, it helps them monitor somebody's symptoms over a period of time. A lot of times when you're in the depths of a mental health crisis, some improvements are hard to see because we are a species that self-deprecates ourselves. We're hard on ourselves, harder than others are on to us. And so by doing those questionnaires, this is an objective way for you to self-evaluate and do that self-reflection, meditation we talked about earlier. So by doing so, we now have objective measurements that we can say, hey, insurance company, this person's PHQ-9 went from like a 6 all the way up to a 17. And now with counseling, it's going back down to a 12. So please continue to pay for that counseling because it's helping this person. And so that's really changed the game there on the e-forms. So you got online appointment booking. Oh, yeah, e-referral. So the next one we use, and this goes back to like 2018, 2017, developed in Cambridge, launched with Cambridge Memorial Hospital, great innovative team down there in Cambridge, and then expanded to Kitchener-Waterloo and then expanded across the province. It allows us to electronically send referrals to another source without using a fax machine. And the advantage of doing that was twofold. There's one disadvantage. The disadvantage is that instead of my secretary having to build that referral, I do. But secondly, I could have made it so that my secretary has to do it. So that's still a possible workflow. But for me, I just select all the things I want to send to that referral, hit a second button, it attaches it, throws it into a browser that then sends it securely to the receiving site. I don't really have to fill out that entire referral form because it automatically pulls it out with my electronic medical record. But I sit there with my patient, I turn the screen to them, I'm like, all right, cool, you need an MRI, type in MRI, hit wait times, and I'm like, cool, if you want to drive to Peterborough, I can get you an MRI in 50 days. If you don't have you only want to go to, like, I don't know, Stratford, sure, that's about a 10-week wait. But now we've increased transparency and we're load balancing the whole system. And so now people are getting, you can get wait times, you can find services that you had no idea existed. I just discovered one that does behavioral medicine with CBT in Toronto. So I sent two patients off yesterday with that. Great communication. So we're going to see how that goes. And so e-referral has changed that. And oh, I forgot. E-referral has changed the way I practice because it meant that I had to get everyone's email addresses. But it also meant that I actually had to start reading my emails because if they wanted to know when their next MRI was or when they're booked, they actually had to go start reading their emails from Ocean. We use Ocean on our for our e-referral platform here in Waterloo. And so that was really helpful because it offloaded my front staff for having to call each person and say, hey, your MRI is booked for this particular date and time, this location, this is the entrance, this is how much parking costs, blah, blah, blah. That's all gone. And patients are there every step. They keep me accountable. I know they know that I sent off the referral. When they call in saying, we haven't heard back about that referral, I'm like, yep, you know as much as I do. If it says they accepted it, but they haven't given me a date and time, I don't have a date and time for you. When you know, I know, and vice versa. So fantastic piece of technology. What we're looking at now is how do we start automating the post-visit technologies.
Thank you for that very thorough answer, Neil. What, you know, there's a lot of physicians still purely clinical and they're not doing anything outside of clinical medicine. There's a big majority of them I find that are wanting to get involved in startups or consulting or innovation or entrepreneurship or even, you know, doing something more administrative that's non-clinical. What piece of advice do you have for them?
It's a great question. I was just at a town hall for one of the organizations I'm an advisor for. And something stuck with me. You have to spend 95% of your time identifying the problem. If you don't know what the problem is in your clinic, you don't know how to advise startup companies. So analyze yourself and analyze your own clinic. And it goes back to, again, that Chinese proverb, if you're standing still, you're moving backwards. If you think your clinic's perfect, oh boy, you are so far behind. I have so much technology in my office, we are still not there. We're still working at it. We're still trying to figure out what the next step is. Because that's when ideation starts. What is the problem we're trying to solve? And then what's the solution to that problem? If we start off with the solution, then we need to create the problem to then solve it. There's only ever been a handful of times when a solution is better, is a newer, better way than the problem itself. But to be fair, the problem always existed. Nobody's been ever took the time to actually find it. So one of the first things I did when I first started my practice, so I'd say about 9 months in, about a year in, was I sat behind my front staff's desk and told them right off the bat, I'm not here to criticize you or judge you. I'm here to learn about what your role is. Because if you guys ever need to take time off or if we suddenly have something that happens, I need to know what you guys do so that I know how to do it myself. So how do you put a fax in? What are all the steps necessary? What do you call patients for? How long do those conversations take? I had a stopwatch, and I had time that those conversations. Again, not to criticize my front staff. They're a fantastic group of people, but more so, how can I help support them? Then I also, at some point, I've done it 3 times now because the roles change all the time, is what does it cost you as a clinician to rehire for that role of your front staff? Because if you keep offloading all the stuff you don't want to do to your staff, they will burn out and you will lose them. People will look for a new job. And so loyalty is important, don't get wrong. You can get loyalty, but you can't buy loyalty. We have this perception, we can and you can't. And so work with them, figure out solutions, co-design with them. Will this work, will this not? Now, there are people who don't like change and there's groups that do like change. I think trying to find the right team is really important. There are some teams that don't like change, and that's probably not the right team if you're looking to do this. But if you're assuming that you do have that right team, yeah, co-design with them, find the solution, implement it, do it on a pilot basis. A lot of companies will give you that pilot aspect or work with a startup company and develop it. Advise them, help them pivot, try and figure out something that actually solves the problem. Now, if a company comes to you and says, I have the solution, you should always ask, what was the problem that you were trying to solve? Well, and the number one thing you should say is, well, when I was a patient, I observed X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, yeah, as a patient, you saw the tip of the iceberg and not all the stuff underneath it. Dive deeper. What else? Who's your expert panel? Are you that expert panel? Do they value your opinion? And if they're dismissing you, run away. Because patient experience and provider experience are two very different things, and they both go hand in hand, but one does not trump the other. So it's really important to co-design, figure that out, and know what your office does for the get-go. And then go talk to your friends. What do their offices do? How do they solve those things? Because an N of one is not really valuable. You need to know what other offices.
Thanks for coming on, Neil. This has been great. And thanks for being open and sharing your thoughts on all the different things we covered.
No problem. My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Always happy to be back.